ends up being a year, and 1 year later, the final result.
The buses are desegregated. It's not about walking. They organize this incredible carpool system. They set up 40 pickup stations all around the city. They're giving, at its peak, 15 to 20,000 rides a day. All of this, right, exceeds every time people take a step. They, again, what is imagined gets broader. And they turn it from a one-day to a year-long boycott from first
come,
first
serve. Story of Rosa Parks. To go to all our interviews with Jean Theo Harris on the rebellious life of Rosa Parks. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hempstead Radio Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP Brookville LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR Loudonville Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Although you see the world different than me, sometimes I can touch upon the wonders that you see. Design. Oh, yes, sweet darling, so glad you are a child of mine, child of mine, child of mine. Oh, yes, sweet darling.
FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio, and 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. You are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert, and we're thrilled today to be joined by Abdurrahman Sharif, Senior Humanitarian Affairs Director for Save the Children. Abdurrahman, thank you so much for coming on our show today.
Thank you for having you guys. Nice to meet you, Richard, as well.
Nice to meet you, too. So before we get into everything, explain to people who might not be aware what Save the Children is and how it started.
Yeah, so Save the Children is what we call an international non-governmental organization. It is an organization that was founded in 1919 by our founder, someone called Eglantine Jebb. She basically saw in children dying of starvation and racked with disease after the end of the First World War. So she launched something called the Save the Children Fund to raise much needed funds to end the children's suffering across war-torn Europe. Today, 100 years later, Save the Children works in many countries around the world, across Latin America, Asia, Africa, give children a healthy start in life, the opportunity to learn and also be protected from harm. Unfortunately, we live in a world where when crisis strikes and children are most vulnerable, they suffer the most, but we're always amongst the first to respond as an organization and the last to leave. Do whatever it takes for children every day and in times of crisis.
What I find the most interesting thing about how your organization started is that it came very shortly after the end of World War One or during World War One times. And yeah. The idea was no matter what, quote unquote, for lack of a better term, side of the war you were on, this was about the children, no matter which side they kind of fell on, because they were innocent parties and the whole thing. And I thought that was a very powerful mindset. Even for today's times, it's powerful, but especially back then.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the tenets of our work. You know, we work around what we call humanitarian principles, and predominantly around humanitarian principles of neutrality, impartiality, independence. And what that means basically is that in any situation of conflict, we should be able to, we do not take sides, help people in need in both parts or both sides of the conflict. And that's very important. And that's what allows us to know to work in so many different parts of the world, so many different contexts. The concept of humanity is all about, you know, helping anyone that needs help, regardless of their political views, regardless of their, you know, gender, regardless of their religion, and on anything that might differentiate them from anything in that sense. And that's the core of our work. That's the tenet of our work. And that's how everything started in Save the Children, actually, to help children who are on the other side of the conflict.
If you could describe some of these humanitarian principles you discussed, I think it would be helpful for the listener.
So basically, you know, let's say that you are in a context where there's a civil war, and I can maybe give, you know, the context of the Democratic Republic of Congo right now, where you have, you know, most part of the countries that is controlled by the government, but also there is a part of the country that is controlled by a movement called M23. So we and other organizations work in both areas. Firstly, we've been working in those areas for many years. We've been present for many years in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We work closely with communities, but we provide, you know, health assistance, education, child protection, water facilities for communities in need. And because we are not taking any sides, we are not, you know, a political organization. We are a non-profit organization. We are accepted by and allowed to work, you know, by different parties in the conflict. Now, that's not always the case everywhere, because, you know, you do not also put your staff at risk. There are places where you can't work because it's too risky for you to send your staff and your teams. But where it's possible, that's, you know, how we are able to work. And there are, you know, four principles mainly that organizations to abide. As I said, you know, neutrality, independence, impartiality are those things. So independence is basically that, you know, nobody tells you where, you know, you should respond or how you should give assistance. You decide based on the needs on the ground. Impartiality is that you do not, you know, choose to give to a person or the other because someone is telling you to do so. You base it based on need. And neutrality is the same. So you don't distinguish. Give the example of the U.S., if you are in the U.S. and there's someone who's from Washington State or New York State, and both are in need, you do not give aid from someone from the New York State because, you know, you are from the New York State. You would give it based on who needs it the most, basically.
You had mentioned briefly the Democratic Republic of Congo. I know there's a lot of areas around the world that you're involved with right now, and a lot of it's for natural disaster, some of it's for conflict. How does Save the Children get involved? Do you pick the places you go to? Do people get in touch with the organization, say, we'd like you to be here? How does that work?
I mean, generally, these are all places. So we've been working for many years, right? We've been in Western Central Africa and the Sahel for many years, in the Democratic Republic of Congo for many years. We work in Haiti. We've been in Somalia for so many years, in the Middle East for so many years, and many countries. And obviously, you know, there is a reason why we started work in those areas, because of a specific need, because of specific conflict. But as I said earlier, we start, we intervene, and we are there to stay until, you know, the needs are addressed. So we try to stay longer with the communities and to assist the communities. And basically, there might be an earthquake happening, and that's where, you know, we intervene in the first place. That's why we start. But then there are other needs that we may identify in that context or in that country and makes us stay as well. So it's different from context to context, but, you know, in difficult contexts, which are humanitarian, which are conflict settings, we try to stay there as much as possible, security obviously permitting. But basically, we come in whenever there is a crisis, a natural disaster, a conflict that calls us to respond, but also when there are huge perceived needs, and specifically for children, because the core of our work and the core of our mandate is to support children. Just look at, for example, Sudan, where we've been working now for many years, but there's been a situation, obviously a conflict situation, for the past 2 years. Think about the child that is caught up in the middle of that conflict. Within 2 years, you know, that child would probably have missed 2 years of education. And that's so important for a child, so important for the foundations of his future. Important not to lose that education, because obviously traditional systems of education have been lost or have stopped and halted. So we try to, within the middle of that, to make sure that, you know, children have a safe space to get educated, a safe space to be children, basically, and also help manage the trauma that it is to be living in a situation of conflict. And we also provide mental health and psychosocial support to children in those situations.
So I'm curious now, because you see the situations, you see, you name Sudan, you name Democratic Republic of Congo, you see what's going on, and then you intervene. How does the intervention process begin? How do you know where the children are? How do you find what the needs are? Walk us through that if you can.
Obviously, you have to look at different sources of information. And what we have is we work, there is a humanitarian coordination framework that is established, that is UN-led. And what they do and what we do on a constant basis is to analyze the information we receive. Sometimes we have staff based in different localities, even from different agencies, that will tell us, look, there are huge needs. We can't respond by ourselves. We need other agencies to intervene and come in to cover, for example, this area. It can be, you know, an education need. It can be a health need. It can be a lack of water. And so there is only space for a certain amount of agencies to be able to respond, and someone needs to cover. So sometimes we will be intervening in that way. So there's a constant flow of information that we do, constant coordination with other agencies that work in a specific country. So this will be UN agencies, this will be other international NGOs, but also local NGOs. Sometimes governments will tell us, look, we've identified a need in this area and we need someone to respond. And so you would need to obviously get ready to respond to that specific need in that specific area. Sometimes it's bringing in medicines, till it's out of medicine. Sometimes it's bringing in nurses and doctors if they don't have enough nurses and doctors to treat, you know, people who require health treatments and children particularly. Sometimes it's staff, or you need people with dedicated expertise. For example, when it is about, you know, safe delivery of babies, or vaccinations, treatment of certain diseases. So the issues will be raised with us. If we have a capacity to respond, we would respond. But obviously, that will also depend on the funding that is available to respond. Because obviously, if you're sending in goods, if you're sending in doctors, you will need also funds to be able to respond to that. And that's why, you know, we rely on the generous contribution of people who donate to Save the Children across the world. And that's what they enable us to do, to be able to respond rapidly and quickly to these different responses. We have a fund that's called the Children Emergency Fund, You may have heard of it, but if you go on every Save the Children website, you will see that, you know, we ask for funds to be raised for that. Those emergency funds allow us to step in from day one when there's a crisis and respond to that crisis as immediately as possible.
So we've spoke about stepping in the process of how you kind of navigate what you're doing. Well, talk about some of the initiatives, but I'd like to ask you about some of the places. You've mentioned Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo. I know Gaza is a very big concern for your organization. We were talking about Ukraine and all these things. If you could just touch on some of the places where you work and the work that you've been doing there, and then we could talk about some of the initiatives later. But just to give people context of the places that you're currently in.
Yeah, so we work in, for example, if I could say, West and Central Africa, in Burkina Faso, in Mali, Niger. We work in Nigeria. In East Africa, we work in Kenya, in Somalia, in Ethiopia, in Tanzania. In Latin America, we work in Colombia, work in places like Peru. And in Asia, we work in Myanmar, we work in Pakistan, we work in Afghanistan, we work in Laos. But all the way also, obviously, to in Europe, we work also in Ukraine. And this is just to give you a snapshot of activities that we do. But the type of projects that you will see us doing is, for example, support or sustain education facilities or the continuation of education facilities in certain contexts where these have been halted. And particularly education, we focus a lot on primary education, sometimes on secondary education. We also, for example, in situations of displacement, so when people are displaced because of a crisis in a context, either in another country or inside the same country, in those displacements camp, you will see us, you know, managing what we call child-friendly spaces, so places actually where children can just, you know, come and play and learn some of the basics. It's a kind of nursery, if you want to call, maybe, in your context, but in very difficult settings, if I may say. And we have, you know, some amazing projects, some very innovative projects as well that we manage. In Jordan, actually, what we're doing is, our Save the Children Jordan office, they're managing a social enterprise. So basically, they run a school for refugees from Syria. Actually, it's a nursery, where kids get to learn the basics. And I went to visit, you know, some of these facilities, and they are of amazing quality. It's something that where I would like to, you know, even send my children if I would be in that context or situation, just because of the quality of what is offered. So we focus on what we call our breakthrough. And our breakthroughs are around three major areas, or I'd say four areas. First is support children to have, you know, a healthy start in life. So we focus on the health sector. We focus on children from the age of, as soon as they're born, up to the age of five, because that's where we see there's the highest risk of death from preventable diseases or preventable causes, we'd say. We focus on providing education, so increasing the reach and quality, rapid and adaptive education responses. We focus on making sure that children are protected, so that so strengthening child protection risks and approving and developing approaches to support that, but also we work on building resilient families, so making sure that we support households and communities to manage economic shocks and financial crises that they may be faced or facing.
Discuss before we get into the health and the resilience and education, if you could discuss some of the places that you're in right now. You were discussing Jordan. If you could tell a little bit about Jordan, a little bit more about some of the places that you work in and what you've been seeing and the work you've been doing there, if that makes any sense, of places you're working. Like, if you could explain, because you have all these great initiatives, and something that kind of stuck with me was that it was starting in the beginning as something that was non-political, non-political, and the work you're doing in Gaza, because Gaza is a very polarizing topic for a lot of people. So how do you kind of keep that initiative up in Gaza? Kind of, we're non-political, we're doing this for a war, because it says on your website, it's a war that these children didn't start. So if you could discuss what you're doing there.
I mean, obviously, that's a very, very difficult context in we are supporting, you know, children in health facilities. We support, you know, children affected by high malnutrition rates and of different kinds. And we have, you know, as I said, a big presence in the Middle East, not just in Gaza, not just in the occupied Palestinian territories, but also in Lebanon, in Yemen. I think, you know, what you will see is just, you know, what I want to say is one of the areas, for example, we are more advanced on is on treating malnourished children, right? So in situations of food crisis and heavy food crisis, was the case in Gaza, like is the case in Sudan, like is certainly the case in places like Somalia, you will see Save the Children running what we call stabilization centers. Stabilization centers are centers within, can be within a health facility, within the health community center, exclusively set up for the children, the treatment of malnourished children, right? So if you see a child that is malnourished, you need to give them, you know, specific treatment for them to be able to recover. For the most critical cases, they might need to stay in a health facility and be supported throughout that process. For the others, it is more about, you know, managing referrals, dealing with their parents, making sure that they get the right medicines. As I said, you know, if you don't treat that, the risk of death from that is very high. The risk of death from children between the age of 0 to 5 is very high. So that's one of the areas that you will see us dealing with. But for example, you know, I was in Afghanistan. I went to visit some health centers, and those health centers basically are treat mother and children. You know, children, for example, require regular vaccinations between the age of 0 and 5. And so we provide health facilities where they will get vaccinated, but also mothers who will also get support and treatment around health issues related to maternal health and be supported also to give safe deliveries. On the education side, it is more about, you know, running or supporting the running of health facilities, training teachers, sometimes providing teachers to health facilities and school. I visited, for example, in Niger, that must have been about a year ago, some schools that we were supporting in areas where there had been no schools or there were no schools. These are predominantly primary education facilities, which were non-existent in those areas. We've built a number of them. And in one of them, I remember that actually the children were actually forcing their parents to take them to school because they enjoyed it. They loved it so much. But also, in a society which was very difficult, you had actually schools being attended predominantly by girls in those areas. And we heard some great stories where some students who came out from those schools actually went on to do their secondary education and were amongst the best students in the country in terms of results for their secondary tests. But then, as I said, you know, the example from the Democratic Republic of Congo is I went to visit IDP camps. So these are displacement camps where people have fled from areas of conflict, moved into the main city of Goma. And there, people had just arrived. We were providing hygiene facilities, water, but also set up some child-friendly spaces that children could come in every day, brought in by their parents, obviously. They will get some form of basic education, but also they will get to play and supported during that time. They are looked at in the child friendly spaces. And this is something that we quite commonly do across different sectors, across different areas. Sometimes what we do also, if there's an outbreak of a disease in some parts of the world, there may be, you know, cases of Ebola that need to be treated or others, we have a mobile health unit that can be deployed in any part of the world and can help with those treatments, whether it is in support of a Ministry of Health or another health facility or a local partner, and basically help with the management of cases and treatment of cases, but also help with campaigns of mass vaccination when they're needed.
Abdulrahman, well, first and foremost, for the listening audience, you're currently listening to the One World Community Radio Show. We thank you so much for being here and tuned in with Abdulrahman Sharif from Save the Children. But we've discussed health a lot during this interview, and we've discussed many of the health initiatives. What I kind of like about your organization is that Obviously, you take care of physical health in many ways, and if there's things you haven't mentioned about that yet, please feel free to discuss them. But you also marry that with mental health care very well, because these people have been through unspeakable trauma. If you could kind of discuss the combination of those two put together, taking care of one's physical and mental health with your organization.
Yeah, I would say it's a whole what we call, you know, we're a child-centric organization, right? So we try to focus on every aspect of the child that is critical for his development, for his growth. And so health plays an important part of it. Education plays an important part of it. And protection plays an important part of it. Because what you have is also situations where children might be recruited by armed groups, you know, to fight for them. And it's important to avoid those, to manage those situations. Or children, you know, who have been recruited by armed groups want to leave and want to come back into a regular of life then, and want to deal with that trauma that has affected them. What we tend to, I think for us, what is important is that, you know, the management of trauma of children. Imagine children who have to, you know, foresee of conflicts, be witnesses to conflict, be witnesses to, you know, family members being killed during those situations, but also, you know, abruptly stopping education, to be on the move constantly. The trauma that, you know, is affecting them is quite relevant. And so we have lots of psychologists that we work with that are specialized in what we call mental health and psychosocial support to children to help them deal with that situation. But also I think it, for us, what is important is for a child to be able to live, you know, and be a child even in those difficult situations. And that's what we try and provide support with. But also, you know, it's also about, you know, making sure that, you know, the standards on child safeguarding, on child protections are maintained as much as possible. Making sure that, you know, with the children that we support, that also we identify any forms of abuse, can try to prevent them or can try to deal with them as they happen by addressing them with the right levels of in authority and addressing those concerns and escalating them where and as needed. For us, you know, if you're able to deal with those essential services which are absent in situations of conflict or in difficult situations where, you know, you're faced with poverty, it's important. And one of the areas you see a lot, I mean, the challenges is because out of poverty, families get, you know, children married. Out of poverty, children go to work. And these are the kind of things we try to avoid, either, you know, by through our work directly, but also by influencing policies and legislations to ensure that those things are not allowed in different countries and different contexts.
We've mentioned education a lot. What is that transition like of bringing the kids back to school after everything they've been through and the work with the psychologists?
I mean, the transition is not easy because, first of all, it depends on the external environment, right? In a situation of conflict, you have situations where a conflict can be short, but you have also situations where a conflict can be protracted, right? So sometimes actually you are supporting the children throughout the process of becoming an adult as well. And then once they're adult, they need to look for jobs in different areas and sectors. But for us, what's important is that sometimes, you know, we live in situations where actually it's adults that are making decisions for children, right? Whether it is their parents or whether it's policymakers or governments or authorities. And so what we focus on is also to make sure that, you know, the children's voices are elevated. So we try to be a vehicle between what the child sees as his need and what the policymaker sees as the need of the child. And make sure that, you know, as much as possible, the child is needs are addressed when legislations are developed or policies are written. So in the case, for example, of work and marriage, is ensure that, you know, in the legislations in different countries that, you know, the age of marriage is regulated, the age at which children can work is regulated as well, so that if it's not respected, you know, people are liable for prosecution, and it also acts as an incentive for people not to get, you know, children married early or children in work when they're not supposed to, into forced labor as well. So it's a process, and it is a long-term process, but it also depends on the situation as an organization, the funding availability, you have to be able to support, you know, that child throughout, you know, his process or their process or her process of their development in that sense. But yeah, so this is, yes, the kind of process we look at and we work with.
That's interesting, because you're almost kind of giving them more of a voice in legislation. That's kind of what your organization does, is it provides a voice to the voiceless, because like we've said throughout the whole time, these children are innocent. They're innocent parties, but you're building this resilience in them, which is something on your website, something you brought up earlier. How do you kind of build the resilience of them to be like speaking up for themselves and standing up for themselves in this time when so much is going against them? I can't imagine being in that position. So how do you see like the growth of the kids from when you start working with them to by the time it finishes, if you could talk about that?
I mean, it's also about confidence. It's also about the settings in certain countries, certain context is you want actually youth to be organized. You want them to be able to speak out. You want to be able to raise their voices, because, you know, the youth are the future of a country or a generation or in a context. And actually, there is statistics to show that actually more you educate children, the more you reduce the instances of conflict and the more you reduce also of poverty. And there is statistics that proves that. And that's why for us, for example, we say, we focus so much on education. You know, when you're working in a crisis, the first thing you say is, you know, you think about is people actually need food, people need health facilities, people need water. Yes, they absolutely need all of that, but they do also need education when they're children. They need to be, do need to be educated so that they can read and write, so that they can, you know, that they can get to work. For us, the way we see it is that the best way to be to deal with resilience is prevention. First of all, if you are know that, you know, there's a risk in a certain context for more death to happen because lack of health facilities has been a recurrent, etc., you can work early to avoid those challenges, to avoid those problems happening. Especially, this is quite predominant in places where you face droughts, right? You know, in different parts of the world, there are places where regularly they face droughts, they face, you know, food crisis, and you generally tend to know which are the areas that are most hit. And so you can preposition yourself, start working early in those areas to make sure that when there's a shock that hits, it is less strong than if you would have responded late, in a sense. But obviously, the resilience to speak out is also about, you know, knowing what channels you can use for children to speak out. Sometimes it's them, you know, getting to meet the officials and presenting their case to officials. So, you know, we have children parliaments that we work with. Sometimes you see children going even at the level of the UN Security Council to speak about their ordeals or the challenges they face. So, and these are children that obviously have confidence to be able to do that. But obviously, you have to support them throughout the process. It's actually just like you and me. I mean, you're a radio host, and the more actually you do radio hosting, you become better at it. It's the same for children. The more they speak out, the more they become better and resilient at it, and the more they get heard, right? And just, you know, look at, you know, two big advocates of this world that we know today, Malala Yousafzai and Greta Thunberg, two great advocates on different issues affecting children. It's a bit, you know, confident voices. And there are many voices like that in different parts of the world that, you know, we work with, we support, that are amazing leaders and obviously the future generation of society, future generation of their countries, and probably future leaders in their countries as well.
Discuss when the kids get to talk to different leaders and when they go to the UN Security Council, because that has to be, I'm sure that's on YouTube, but that has to be so powerful to witness.
It's extremely powerful. I think the last one you will see on YouTube was a Syrian child who spoke to the UN Security Council about the ordeal and the challenges of Syria, but also the new opportunities ahead. And that, you know, is just so powerful to hear. You don't hear that every day when you are in the decision-making table or decision powers as well. So to hear the reality from the ground, from someone who can speak about it so eloquently and such in a clear language is really powerful and and mind-blowing, I would say the least. And sometimes, you know, you talk about the situation or a context or a conflict and you don't, you know, hear about the reality on the ground. So, you know, having those voices to be able to talk about the reality of the ground is just powerful to understand people, what that means, and how the situation is difficult for certain populations and certain vulnerable communities. So absolutely powerful. And we always encourage that. We, you know, try to push for that more, even, you know, whether it's at international, whether it's at country level to speak to the leaders, whether it's at regional level, like, you know, platforms like the African Union, where we can, you know, get, you know, children from different parts of Africa to speak to their leaders at the African Union. Those are all, you know, very important platforms. And I, you know, I worked in a government in the previous jobs I had, and it was difficult to get, you know, to hear those voices. So it's very important to hear those voices so that, you know, it can influence policy changes and people can think about it when they are putting together legislations or policies or making decisions.
Well, you said about the kids still having optimism. I think we've discussed the whole time, and you've touched on it briefly. Now we're going to get talk about it. We've discussed the displacement centers, having to remove the kids from where they are, and everything they've gone through and having to go back to school, and the hunger, and this and that. And I'm trying to even think, oh, the trauma and everything they've been through. But you also set up those play centers, and you let them still be kids. And I think that's very important, and I think that must have a big psychological effect on them that makes them feel more, quote-unquote, normal in a situation they never should be living through, and by all means is not.
Absolutely. I would say, you know, that is key. And I think, you know, sometimes when you're dealing with a big crisis, an earthquake, a food crisis, a conflict war that creates displacements, you think, as I said, you know, you think about the immediate crisis, the fact that you want to take people out of hunger, that you want to give people shelter, that you want people to get, you know, health assistance if they're injured. But actually, you sometimes forget that people also want a normal life, and the normal life is living out of that conflict, not having to think about it. And those child-friendly spaces that I mentioned is a safe haven for those children to try and have a normal life, a place where they can play football, soccer, basketball with kids, tennis, a place where they can read books, a place where, you know, they can just play with toys. And that's, you know, the normality of just being a kid. And it gets it tends to be forgotten many times, and that's why it's important for organizations like us who are dedicated to children to highlight and to raise that and to talk about that more and more, because, you know, children have to deserve or have a right to be children and just live as children, even in situations as difficult of conflicts, wars, famines.
Have you ever, like, after a conflict, I know the tragedy of your organization is that a lot of the conflicts are ongoing, but with conflicts that have kind of reduced or ended, or and even people recovering from natural disaster, do you ever hear back from kids who you've helped in the future of what the organization did for them?
We do. We do. We do hear of people who worked, you know, with Save the Children, who have been assisted by Save the Children, and end up doing, you know, bigger things in life. Some of them, you know, have become political leaders. Some of them have had good jobs in their life. And you know, that's kind of the positive transformation that you want to have in kids, and positive change that you want to make in kids. And that's where, you know, makes us proud as an organization. If you have that story of someone that you've supported across and you know, and end up doing all these amazing things, it's a fantastic story to tell or to talk about. Yeah, those are some of the achievements. I can't give specific concrete examples right now, but you know, those are some of the examples. Say there's quite a few.
What does that mean for the people at your organization? That must mean that the work you do, that must fulfill you guys.
It fulfills a lot. And you have people who've been working for this organization for so many years and really are dedicated. And as I said, you know, just go and see some of the facilities we support. places like Jordan, educational facilities. It's a place where if you had children, you would send your own kids, right? Because we are an organization that focuses a lot on quality of our programs, right? And the quality is, if I am going to get, you know, health treatment or vaccination, I want the people of that I support to receive the same type of quality health facilities that are provided within that context, obviously. And I think that's something that the organization focuses a lot, invests a lot, and he's invested a lot over the years. The fact that, you know, we've worked for 100 years means that we've also learned from mistakes, from things that were done in the wrong way. We've learned through that history, and that's how we continuously improve our ways of working. But again, also, we have the ability to work immediately faced with a crisis or a natural disaster. And I think that's what puts, you know, Save the Children in a unique position. But every day we receive so many amazing stories of achievements, impact that the organization does. And that's really, really rewarding. And I sit in London, but, you know, the key people are those people who are working in different countries who are working in difficult contexts. You know, sometimes, you know, if you are from a certain country that has a conflict, it's people around you, actually, that you live with every day who are suffering. So it's not easy also to deal with those situations.
Looking at the future, obviously, a big initiative of Save the Children Now will be combating the climate crisis and global warming and the effects of that. How, in the current age, are you looking at food insecurity and hunger and natural disaster differently because of what's going on in the environment right now?
I think, unfortunately, those are going to be on the increase. Disruptions, but also big inequalities around the world between poor and rich, and those are going to create also inequalities that have an impact on children. That means that also we have to work more smartly, and so some of the areas we are investing more in is, for example, how we can work more and more with local organizations, local partners, or local governments in certain contexts to be able to build their or champion their capacities to be able to respond to these situations in the long run. But climate, you know, is going to be a big issue. The increase of natural disasters, whether it's drought, whether it's floods, whether it's climate-related events, are going to be an increase, and as a result, displacements to that. So we are analyzing those trends. We are trying to work them out, as I said, but also anticipate them. So if we know that in a certain country, you know, there's going to be floods happening on a recurring basis, we'll try to prevent the impact of that communities and work with communities. For example, you know, not build school or help build schools close to flood-affected areas or hospital facilities that may be damaged if there's a natural crisis, natural disaster. Same with, you know, areas that are helped by earthquake or other situations. So we try and always, you know, work one step ahead, analyze what's happening in the future in a context, and be able to adapt also our programs in relation to that. But the challenges, you know, we still have lots of big challenges ahead. We have conflicts that are on the increase. We have climate-related the events that are on the increase, and if I tell you, you know, the list of events that, you know, come to my table or issues that are highlighted on a daily basis, there is an earthquake, you know, happening now on regular basis in different parts of the world. There are floods, there are different sorts of disasters that impact on children and which require us to respond and respond quickly.
Responding quickly and looking at the future, what are ways that Save the Children is ramping up their efforts to handle the crises of today and look ahead of the future, more or less with natural disaster, because you can't predict the tragedies that will arise in conflict. But how do you prepare for the future?
So the example I know better is probably the example of Somalia, where I'm originally from, where we have on an annual basis different sites of climate-related events. We either have droughts and we have floods. We know that, for example, when there's a drought, the communities that are the most affected by these in terms of food security and lack of food and availability of food are in specific regions which are more remote and all of that. So we've improved. There've been a lot of investment in technologies to analyze data, to understand, you know, the trends, understand when droughts are going to happen, when floods are going to happen, so that, for example, we can work with communities to preposition food items, preposition, you know, water facilities, or provide people more access with water facilities, so that when those they are hit by a drought, they are better prepared and more resilient in that sense to contain the shock of that. Or, for example, because we know, you know, that there are floods, there are things that we can do in the immediate, for example, respond after a flood to populations who are displaced. But there are things that can be done in the long term. And sometimes we need to advocate other actors that need to intervene. So, for example, we always say that we need both humanitarian actors and development actors to work hand in hand to address immediate needs, but also root causes. So in a situation of a flood like in Somalia in the rivers, what's the immediate need is to respond after a flood to a food crisis or a displacement crisis that has affected the community. What is the long-term need is to stop floods happening. And the way you stop floods happening is you create irrigation canals maybe, you create, you know, barrages across the rivers that will manage floods so that you reduce the floods and you build infrastructure to reduce the floods. If you don't build those investments, then you'll have continued floods across and across and across. If you don't have, you know, water facilities in areas that are hit by drought, then people will be affected by lack of water. And one of the things you have in during drought seasons and heavy droughts is actually the water prices go up high and skyrocket. And one of the things you could do is work with authorities to say, actually, during those periods, can you limit the prices or put legislations to limit the prices of water? Or you would, you know, put in more water facilities in a specific context. So there are specific things that you can do immediately in the short term, but there are also things that you can prepare to reduce the amount of crisis or stop a crisis from happening in the long term.
And something else that is interesting that you guys do is on your website, there's information that provides ways that parents can educate their children about the conflicts of the world. If you could discuss those initiatives briefly, because I thought that was interesting too, because like, when do you tell these kids what's going on? How do they find out about it? If you could discuss that for a minute.
Obviously, you know, Save the Children is an organization that works in many countries. So we work internationally, but we also have, you know, different members that work in the US, in the UK. And in those countries, we support vulnerable communities, or our members support vulnerable communities, poor communities, but also work with schools to make them understand what's happening in different parts of the world. So we work, yes, with parents. We work, yes, with schools to create campaigns so that children can understand what's happening around the world. But also, I think, you know, the amazing part of Save the Children is that some of our best fundraisers in the different countries in which we raise money for our work globally are actually children. So those children at schools, once they understand the challenges that others of their peers face in other parts of the world, will be the first ones to raise money for them. And that's, you know, an amazing gesture of solidarity. I think, you know, we have an international solidarity movement across the world, not just Save the Children, but, you know, between people, that is so powerful. That cannot be disconnected, so matter how, and that, you know, creates so much interconnections between people of different cultures around the world. And you know, that's something so powerful, something that's so rewarding for people like me and you to see in this context.
And I think that was a lovely sentiment, but we're about to wrap up, Abdulrahman. So if you have any takeaways that you want people to have about Save the Children from this interview, what would you like people to take away from this?
I think, you know, to understand that, you know, we are still facing a lot of challenges around the world. And, you know, whatever people can support to, whether it's their time to fundraise, whether it's time to give, you know, to work and support initiatives like ours, please do give time to that. But also whatever gesture you can show, which you can show solidarity, is important. That, you know, to understand that in different places, we are also a voice for the voiceless. The people and the listeners are also a voice for the voiceless. So whenever you can raise that voice to highlight a conflict, to highlight a difficult situation affecting children around the world, please do so. And please do support us in raising the challenges that children face around the world. Thank you.
And if people want to find out more about your international solidarity movement and about Save the Children and the work that you're doing and potentially get involved, where can they turn to? What are the resources?
So obviously the resource is our website, www.savethechildren.org. You'll find anything about the history, about our work, about how to donate, but also about how to work with organizations like ours. So please, you know, go have a look at our website. Go and I'm sure there's lots of things and resources that you'll see are available for you. And also our members, Save the Children US, Save the Children UK, and others have also websites if you wanted to more and more about also the domestic side of their programs and what you could do, for example, in with schools in the different countries. So please go and have a look at our website.
And on that note, Abdulrahman, thank you so much for sharing about Save the Children with us on the show today. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We thank you for listening. You've been listening to the One World Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU, Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, 88.3 WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM, Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens julle.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio.
past your house, feeling like a refugee and a louse. You were at home, but you were not alone. You were there with your kids and your spouse. I walked right past your house. Yes, and I'm feeling bereft. It's the same, it's still all here, but nothing is left. I'm feeling bereft. You leave someone behind and you think you won't mind until you go back and find you still care. Yeah, you're back where you started, undermined, outsmarted by in your town. I'm walking around, crossing the street, unsure on my feet, and I'm carefully
refill.